Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a decade now, business people and more have been thumbing away on their BlackBerries. Nice. But you've probably noticed how the Apple iPhone, essentially a whole computer in your hands, has become the it technology in 2 short years. The other giants of the tech world, Google, Microsoft, the telecom firms, are racing in, laying down big bets on smartphones and mobile computing. This hour, On Point smartphones and the implications of mobile computing taking off and taking over. You can join the conversation. Have you crossed over? Are you carrying a computer in your pocket? Is a smartphone just another gadget to you or something else entirely? Does it change the way you compute, do business, live? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Austin, Texas, is Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. You've heard him on All Things Considered. He's a contributor to NPR's All Tech Considered. Omar, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, tell us about the hook this week. There's something about Android coming in to compete with iPhone. Help us start with the basics here. What is the news we're hearing just in the sale of products this week? What is it, and what's it tell us about what's going on with mobile computing smartphones?
Well, Android is a platform that Google has backed that is more of an open source platform than the iPhone, and so it's an operating system that, you know, any wireless carrier can incorporate into a new cell phone.
And a couple of dozen have, or something like that, already picked up their operating system for a smartphone.
Yeah, last year the first was the T-Mobile G1. That was the first Android handset that we saw. But coming up is one called the Droid, and you might have seen some commercials for it, the I Don't commercials, which are taking the iPhone directly to task. This is the first time we've seen another competitor really, really go after the iPhone in such a direct attack. So the Droid phone, which is expected to come out early November, will carry the Android 2.0 software, which is a pretty major revamp to this Android software. Now, you know, Android is a very powerful platform. You know, they've got a marketplace app store similar to what the iPhone has. This phone in particular is expected to have a very powerful camera that can shoot some HD video and take photos up to 5 megapixels. So, you know, there's a lot of anticipation for the Droid, but it's just one of several Android phones that are coming out this year. It seems like the Android platform is really coming into its own after a year of just one or two handsets out there that use that operating system.
Now, the significance of that is, of course, Apple came out with iPhone. It's been a huge success. They've sold 21 million plus units of that. But Google has jumped in as well, which means it's also in the smartphone mobile computing business. They had to clear out their boards of directors of each other's presence because they're computing. And Google, another big power here, offering a really effective operating system so that manufacturers of the actual phone can plug it in, as is going on now with Droid, and suddenly they're competitors to Apple.
Right, and you know, and Google has its hands in so many different businesses. I mean, I think the board of directors thing had a little bit more to do with apps in the App Store, like Google Voice, but that's a whole other story. But then, you know, you've got Research in Motion with the BlackBerry platform as well. Microsoft is still hanging in there with its Windows Mobile platform, and then, you know, you've got Symbian, which is still you know, the dominant operating system, which I guess you would see more in what we would call dumb phones as compared to smartphones, but still a lot of people are still carrying around, you know, Razors and older phones that are not what we would call, you know, the big touchscreen, fully featured smartphones. You know, there's still a huge audience of people who have still not made the transition to smartphones, I think wireless carriers would do well not to ignore that audience as well.
But that industry is in trouble now. Their sales are down of regular old dumb phones or cell phones, while the smartphone sales, I mean, looking here at Europe, sort of the old-style phones down 20-something percent, smartphones up 20-something percent this year.
Right, and smartphones, that market is expected to hit about 412 million units by 2014. So definitely smartphones is going to be the growth market. And a lot of that has to do with pricing. You know, when you have an iPhone that gets down to $99, that's really kind of the sweet spot for these kinds of phones. I mean, when the Motorola Razr went down to $99, that was when it had that huge surge in sales and became kind of the dominant cell phone for a while. So yeah, that's happening with iPhone. You're going to see Android phones probably, you know, starting at like $199 and going down to $99 as time goes goes on. And, you know, but what we, the danger is that when a new platform comes out, like, say, the Palm, the new Palm Pre that came out this year, started with a lot of buzz in January. You know, people were really excited about it. And when it came out by summer, it already felt, Apple had just come out with the 3GS. Mm-hmm. It felt like the Palm Pre just hadn't caught. It was already kind of DOA when it arrived and really has lost a lot of momentum.
Because the frontier is moving so fast here, it's hard to stay out front.
Right, and it's very hard to keep up with Apple. You know, other people come out with phones that seem competitive, and then Apple turned around and introduced the 3GS, which was faster and introduced video recording, and then dropped the price on the 3G to $99, which was a huge, industry-shaking move. So, yeah, Apple is definitely kind of carrying the torch right now, and Android is a very powerful platform and seems to grow in popularity by the day, but Apple seems to still be the one with its huge marketplace of 85,000 apps and all these developers creating things for it. It just seems to grow every day.
And the headline just out today from PC World saying Apple set to pass 100,000 available iPhone apps milestone. That is a lot of stuff you can do on your smartphone. Give us a sense of the range of apps that are out there now, Omar.
Well, you know, this marks kind of a big shift in the way cell phones themselves are. 2 years ago, I was talking to someone at Frog Design about, his biggest complaint about designing for cell phones was that the wireless carriers weren't opening their platforms to outside development. That was really stifling innovation. When Apple launched the App Store, that really opened it up to extending the capabilities of a cell phone the way a home PC can, you can install different software that you buy mm-hmm. at the store. It's definitely a big shift. So with the iPhone, I mean, you've got everything from navigation apps to productivity apps. Video games have become really hot for the iPhone. Pretty much any kind of software you can imagine holding in your hand and more is available for the iPhone. And, Apple certainly doesn't have the resources to develop 100,000 different applications on its own, but the developer community has definitely rallied behind it, and they're seeing, lots of opportunities for making money on these apps. And even the free apps, in some way serve a market of promoting a company or providing content that can lead to some other kind of sale. So, it definitely, the App Store has been a huge, huge success story for Apple.
And now, I mean, you can watch NASA missions, follow them on your app. You've got Offender Locator downloaded more than a million times, where you can sort of check out anybody's background in an instant. They're saying, go out on a date while you're on the date, or you can check the guy or gal you just sat down with to see, like a policeman sitting in their car with their full laptop to see who exactly is this. Omar Gayaga, please stand by in Austin, Texas. We're joined right now as well from New York by John Abel, New York Bureau Chief for Wired.com. John, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
So we've sort of been talking about the line between old-time cell phones, dumb phones, you might say, and smartphones. I'm reading here Google boss CEO Eric Schmidt saying, the line is really that you should pay attention to is between the smartphone and the PC, that's where it's getting fuzzy. The smartphone is getting up in the face of the personal computer in its capacity now.
Well, that's exactly right. Mobile computing is the newest hot space. Although Steve Ballmer has jokingly said that the internet was invented for the PC, it's simply not true. The shift that we're looking at now is the same kind of paradigmatic shift that we saw when broadband was introduced, and people realized that they could be engaged with the internet all the time, that they could turn around, push a button, and see the weather. Check the time, communicate with their friends. Now we're realizing that there isn't any place or any time that we can't be engaged with the medium, and the medium connects us to everything.
And I've watched people when they first get a smartphone kind of change. Their eyes get wide suddenly. They're checking all kinds of stuff all the time. I mean, it sounds kind of just elementary. You could do this at your PC. Now you can do it on the road. But there's something about it being mobile that changes the way people interact with the whole world of computers, John.
Sure, that's exactly right. It's as if you no longer are tethered to a place because of power or connectivity. One of the reasons I think people believe the Kindle has done so well is because it provided you connectivity, WhisperNet. It had a huge advantage over the Sony ebook reader for a long time. Mm-hmm. Because you could take your connectivity anywhere. You could make that purchase on an impulse anywhere you wanted. So mobility, which is power and connectivity, is where it's at.
Power, connectivity, And Omar, when you put those things together, it just changes the way people, from my observation, it changes their sense of sort of their capacity in the world as they walk through life, the way they're interacting with what's around them. Everything's GPS powered here, so your little mini computer in your hand, a mobile computer knows where you are. It can interact with the scene right around you, people's social networking. Even as they walk, talk, and go, you know, it's not my thing, but my buddies are so into it, they just can't quit. They really feel sort of like a new species out there.
It's certainly kind of a function of feeling connected all the time. And you know, I think the BlackBerry kind of ushered that era in of you know, business people, you know, having to be connected to email all the time, having to be connected to messaging all the time. And really, smartphones have evolved in that direction, especially with the location-aware stuff where, you know, you're walking down the street in New York and you want to know where the nearest restaurant to get pizza or a movie theater is. And, you know, you don't have to enter an address anymore even. You just, you know, look, it finds you through GPS and tells you what's nearby and shows you a map of it, you know, all in one step. And I'm finding even the home, you know, I'm seeing that. I mean, if I want to know what the weather's going to be like today, I don't go upstairs to the desktop PC or open my laptop anymore. I just look to my phone. So even with, you know, when there is a computer nearby, I tend to opt for the phone because it's just a lot easier and quicker and it's right there in my pocket.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about smartphones and mobile commuting taking off finally and taking over maybe and what that means for our lives, our economy. With us today, Omar Gayaga. He covers technology and its culture for the Austin American Statesman. You may have heard him on NPR's All Things Considered. He's terrific. John Abel's with us from Wired.com in New York, New York bureau chief there. We're just kind of trying to take the measure of what this means for the way we do things. Let's get some callers right here. Bruce in Foxborough, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling on my iPhone.
Of course.
And the point I wanted to make was that I've had handheld computers for 15 years or so, mm-hmm. going way back to the Apple Newton and the Palm Pilot, and then
sure.
more recently a Windows Mobile smartphone. But now that I have the iPhone, it's really the first time I've ever felt comfortable using it for things like email and web browsing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I couldn't do it on those other devices, but it's probably two things. One, the iPhone just works much more smooth. It's kind of about the experience. And, you know, your expert earlier was saying how it's easier to use the phone now than the computer, even when the computer's right nearby.
Do you find that's true, Bruce?
Until now.
Do you find it true now?
It's been true until now, though.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, that was the big difference. The other thing is, you know, to be honest, the iPhone synchronizes better with Microsoft Outlook on my computer better than the Windows mobile phone did.
So you've got your whole calendar right there and syncing up better than it did in the family. Are you always aware that you can know basically anything, anytime, just looking down into your hand, Bruce?
Well, I got to say, though, yes, I do. But I got to say, one important lifestyle decision that I made was I do not have push email turned on. Because I just think that's not a good way to live your life.
Overwhelmed by incoming mail all the time.
It just sets up a lot of bad habits. And it's like you were saying, you can get a little too addicted to it. And it's not, I just don't think that's healthy.
And maybe miss the world that you're actually walking through. Bruce, thank you. Joshua in Nashua, New Hampshire. You're on the air, Joshua.
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just kind of wanted to raise what's probably going to be a different perspective. The iPhone is really kind of interesting because it basically gives you a lot of functionality that most people haven't had in a mobile device, more or less out of the box. But there's a whole another type of smartphone. The Android platform's a little bit more interesting, but there's another product called the OpenMoco. I don't know if you or any of your guests have heard of it.
OpenMoco. We'll find out. What about it, Joshua?
Well, it's basically it's a much more open platform, and it's open to development by users. So, I mean, if you want to develop an application for the iPhone, the process for actually getting that application onto the iPhone
mm-hmm.
and actually sharing it with anybody else is very restrictive and controlled by this central authority, which is Apple.
You have to get
approval by Apple and get it into the store, and they have very strict rules for what they will prove. For example, they won't allow more than one application in the store that does the same thing. So basically, you're stuck with whatever they give you still. And it's a lot of stuff, but you're stuck with whatever they give you. Whereas the OpenMoco project is basically based on allowing everybody who has one of these phones to basically do whatever they want with it.
Whoop. Careful, please. We don't want to have a first here. Joshua, I think we've got that. Watch out for the train or the bus there. John Abel, this Apple's got a kind of closed and tended garden here. There's Google's more open. OpenMoco, I don't know if you know it, maybe more open still. Is the speed of the development of apps going to depend on that openness or not here?
Well, you could make a case for it. It's more about who gets to get an app on a platform than the speed of it. There have been some horrible stories out of Apple about things that have been delayed and denied and whatnot. But the truth of the matter is, the fact of the matter is, they have an astonishing number of applications that do pretty much everything. A lot of developers have become very successful and somewhat wealthy in a very short amount of time. I don't want to argue against open systems, because at Wired we're all about open systems.
Sure.
But in order to be a success, you need many ingredients. For better or for worse, Apple has hit upon a formula which resonates very, very widely.
No kidding. The sales show it. And yet, if this becomes the norm, a lot of people are going to be in the pool already. I want to get one more voice here from Los Angeles, if I may. Jason Calacanis joins us, CEO of Mahalo.com, a human-powered search engine, co-founded with CEO of Weblogs, the big network that sold to AOL in 2005. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
I hear, you know, every day people picking these things up and talking about how they are a revelation. But is there really a revolution here? Or is this just, you know, PCs walking around, so what?
No, this is a revolution. I mean, what you're capable of doing with this device is much more in line with what you're capable of doing with a computer than a mobile phone. In fact, the majority of the behavior on an iPhone is not talking on the phone, and the processing power on it is pretty extraordinary, and the rate of innovation with the application platform is stunning. And in addition to that, they've created, again, Apple, an ecosystem for monetization. And that's a key thing here, is that the developers can actually make money from this platform and bill it seamlessly to the customers. They don't need to create a billing system. They can just give Apple their VIG, 30% or whatever it is, and be off to the races making money, which is what Apple did quite successfully to build essentially a monopoly in the MP3 player space. So Apple's become the master at being seemingly open and user-centric because they have great design and great products, while being very draconian, Microsoft-like, and building a closed platform.
But apart from making money, no small deal in itself, and, you know, the economy can use any boost, I guess, but in terms of the fabric of our lives, the way we interact, what we accomplish as individuals or collectively, does it matter that all that computing power goes, you know, wherever it goes instead of being on the desk?
This is going to launch a whole new collection of applications that haven't been possible before.
Like?
When you have something, well, the first one is essentially a satellite truck in your pocket. There's a piece of software called Quick, Q-I-K, that's available on a number of platforms, including the iPhone. And that allows you to stream from your camera to the web, and then from the web to thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And so, as we saw in the revolution going on in Iran or other places.
The famous footage there of Neda Aga Sultan, the woman sort of shot and dying on camera.
Right. And the next phase of that will be, we'll be watching that live or, you know, a hostage situation or whatever it is. The world's going to unfold live. And it's not, it sounds crazy right now, but it's quite possible that your seat at Yankee Stadium for the World Series, sorry to the Boston fans, will be streaming from your iPhone in HD to the quality level of what Major League Baseball is showing. So then if you imagine that, there are 10,000 camera angles in the audience in HD. That's 5 years away. And it's quite, it's possible on a technical level right now. There are some battery limitations and bandwidth limitations.
So the whole world is watching will be true in an even bigger way, not that single eye or three network eyes, but all the eyes of the world, in effect.
Huge fundamental change. And then on a social networking basis, there's a very clever application called Foursquare. And what that lets you do is check into a place. So you're at your local coffee shop in Manhattan, Balthazar or something. You click, I'm here. It sends to your social network that you're in Balthazar. And this application seems like a silly little game, but it becomes very practical when you're at an airport. And I did this recently. I checked in at an airport, and somebody else was in the same terminal as me, and we went and had a cup of coffee.
No more tragically missed romantic moments there. You'll know.
No more missed encounters. Mm-hmm. And it's building data that has never existed before, which is if we're in one social network and I come to Boston and we're all friends in the Boston network, or you come to Los Angeles, you could see what your friends in Los Angeles are doing and do most. These are the places your friends in Boston go to most. These are the places your friends in New York go to most. This is data that has never been collected and never been used. And the final application, which is completely mind-blowing, is a new category called augmented reality. Mm. And what this means is mixing virtual reality, which we talked about probably in 1995 and 96, mm-hmm. when that was the hot topic and never really came to fruition, which is a virtual world, people walking around in it. You mm-hmm. have it in video games, but mm-hmm. that's about as mass as it got. But this is combining the camera and virtual information. So you take out your phone, point it at the real world, point it at a building and say, what is that? Who's in that building? And then all of a sudden, it puts metadata, little pieces of information, on the building and says, on this floor is IBM. On this floor is, Saks Fifth Avenue. And it's taking data and pointing at the world. And a company has actually came out with this, a company called Yelp, Y-E-L-P, which is popular. Mm-hmm. And what you can do is take out your phone and say, I want pizza. And you look at the real world, and it puts virtual signposts, for mm-hmm, MASH, New York City. With the labels. And this has never existed before. So these categories of applications, mobile social networking, augmented reality, and cameras everywhere in high speed, massive game changers on the level of the Internet itself.
Wow.
Most people in the world are not going to connect to the Internet over their computers, which is a massive sea change, and that's happening right now. Majority of people in countries like China, India, are accessing the Internet over their mobile phones. In Japan, this is already happening.
Yeah, I'm seeing here on, this is on the Daily Dish, the blog, somebody saying that Nicholas Negroponte shouldn't have got after one laptop per child, but one smartphone per child. Be smaller, easier, and it's happening. Let's go to Gray in Burlington, Vermont. Gray, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm actually just Burlington, Vermont, and I have to call in and kind of agreeance with the respondent now talking about all the different applications mm-hmm. and the social media apps, as well as the location finders, the GPS, the satellite finders. I myself am a little bit younger than a lot of the people who've probably been calling or will call in. I have also had the desktop, the last laptop, the first original handheld PCs in the green format. I now have a netbook. And between my desktop, my laptop, my netbook, and my iPhone, I find that for more commonalities, I tend to use my iPhone. I find it easier sometimes to check and respond to email. As far as, if somebody has a medication that they have a question about, instead of mm-hmm. opening up the netbook or a laptop or desktop, having things charge up, putting in a password, you just pull out your iPhone, you type in the medication, and there's an application that right then and there finds about the information that's needed.
So what's the difference? What does it matter, Gray, that it's that present and easy? I mean, you could have done it another way. Does it really change the interaction?
It's information at your fingertips. It's mm-hmm. information at your fingertips. If you ever have a question, it's almost, iPhone to iPhone, who can find it faster? If you have the iPhone G versus the iPhone GS.
Quick draw.
As far as, quick draw, yeah. And it's kind of funny. Another fellow friend of mine, we're looking for a phone number. He has the GS, I have the G. And he goes, let's see if you can find it faster. And just out of luck, he happened to use the Internet, and I was trying to use one of my apps, and he actually found it faster. It's completely changed my life in response to technology. I always have the iPhone on me. I always have it plugged in and, charged up.
Great, we've got it. You're the thoroughly modern man right there, and I appreciate your call. Let me get a different voice just down the pike here. Michelle in Westminster West. Michelle, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. We moved up to Vermont recently from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. We've been back and forth for years, and now we're there all the time. And when I visit in Cambridge, I'm really struck by the difference in the quality of life on the street and on the road because of the incredible prevalence of cell phones. And I'm not a Luddite, and I have iTunes and kids that have taught me how to use all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I am interested in hearing what people have to say who are so involved and so knowledgeable about a genuine lack of connection that's happening all over. I'm just struck by the radical difference when I walk down the street in Brattleboro and drive on the roads up there.
What you mean, in Cambridge, everybody's glazed into their device, their e-device, their smartphone.
Well, it seems to be to me. I mean, I saw a woman almost get run over because she was walking and talking on her cell phone, and a man was driving and talking on his cell phone.
Right.
I thought, this woman's
Boom.
Dead.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Omar, you must see that in Austin, Texas as well. I mean,
We just passed a texting ban in Austin just last week. That goes into effect in January, so it's been a really hot topic here.
You can't walk and text, or you can't drive and text?
Driving. You can walk and text. No.
But I mean, this idea of a lack of connection brought on by the ultimate inconnectivity is the irony that hits you right across the face here.
Well, you know, to Jason's point earlier about some of the apps, I mean, it occurred to me that the technology is moving faster than a lot of people are actually comfortable with it. Things like Foursquare. I'm not on Foursquare because I frankly don't want people to know where I'm checking in from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly don't want a mobile app that tells people that from moment to moment. I don't think David Letterman would have wanted that the last couple of years.
He can run, but he can't hide.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, you know, and I was talking to AT&T a couple of weeks ago about they're developing kind of face-to-face video chat, you know, where you'd be able to make a phone call and kind of the whole idea of the video phone. A lot of people don't want that. A lot of people I talk to say, I don't want someone to see me when we're having a phone conversation. I don't want to be on camera. So I think, you know, a lot of the times the technology is there, but the comfort level isn't. Just because you build something doesn't mean people are going to want to use it. And in the matter of just culturally, I think, you know, it's moving so fast that, you know, the three of us on talking to you today are going to embrace this stuff, but a lot of people won't.
And a lot won't, a lot will. Giuseppe is tweeting right now. He's listening to On Point Radio about smartphones on his iPhone via public radio player. I mean, people are really plugged in. John, do you think that the level of transparency that comes with this wherever, whenever awareness is going to be welcome, going to be resisted, both? Does it ultimately win? We, you know, human beings just go for knowledge no matter what?
Yeah. The early part of the curve whenever something dramatic like this happens is always very skewed. So we have people that aren't quite used to the idea of being immersed in something in a public setting, and so you have people actually texting from the driver's seat and getting run over. I mean, we had problems like that when the car was introduced and an other sea change type technologies. But I mean, those things do tend to settle down, and adoption follows a natural evolutionary course. For example, one of the differences between the picture phone technology and sort of the mobile commuting technology is that picture phones have been around technically since the 1930s. They were introduced at the World's Fair. They're reintroduced every few years. Nobody wants that. They put them on phones. Nobody wants that feature. But when you introduce a mobile computing platform that allows you to access information and the people that matter to you on a real-time basis, suddenly everybody loves that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about smartphones and mobile commuting taking off, taking over, and what that means for our lives, our work, our economy. Jason Calacanis is with us, CEO of Mahalo.com, joins us today from Los Angeles. John Abel is here from New York. He's bureau chief there for Wired.com. And the great Omar Gayaga is with us from the Austin American Statesman in Austin, Texas. You may have heard him on NPR's All Things Considered or at All Tech Considered. And we've got a lot coming in. Here's Olivia at our website saying, I'm listening to the show live on my Palm Pre at this very moment. Don't get radio reception in my cube, but never miss my favorite NPR shows, thanks to my smartphone. Every day, she says, I use it for navigation, email, texting, Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, live radio, and even the occasional phone call. Olivia says, I literally can't imagine functioning without it. On the other hand, David says, to quote my wife, cell phones are the new smoking. They invade one's personal space like secondhand smoke. Oh, and anyone tried to teach an undergraduate class lately everybody looking down, I guess, on their smartphone. And John says, you know, this iPhone's the most amazing technology I've ever had. You know, I've got everything I need in one device. And off we go. Fred in Troy, Michigan. You're on the air, Fred.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I use a Crackberry. I mean, a Blackberry.
Whoop,
but,
yeah.
The reason for my call, Tom, I used to have a business where I was helping people get smartphones and mobile devices implemented. And the ease of use now has actually put me out of business. And the other reason I was calling is I'm a nerd type, a computer nerd type. I mean, I have a server computer at home. I have three computers running as well as a wireless network and everything.
Okay.
And, yes, I reach for my phone for information more than I do get on the computer to check the weather, stocks, sports, all that stuff right off of my phone. I barely turn on the computer anymore unless I'm really doing some serious work.
And you're a serious nerd type, as you say, and still it's all in your hand there in Troy, Michigan. Thank you, Fred. Evansville, Indiana. April, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I was just saying I have an iPhone, but I was not an easy convert. My husband had one, and I refused to get one until recently. And I found that it's quite useful as a teaching tool in my classroom. I have a small preschool age classroom, and I'm able to, instead of have flashcards, put pictures on it and do other things with it that I couldn't do with any other phone, and I don't have to drag my laptop with me either. So I just think it's a wonderful device.
April, what level of students do you teach? Is it grade school, high school, college?
At preschool right now, I teach Spanish, so it's really great to be able to put those pictures up on the screen and everyone gathers around and we talk about different things. I can even do stories on my iPhone.
But presumably because they're in preschool, they don't have their own iPhones yet, so they're not off, you know, playing video games while you're trying to teach them uno, dos, tres. Yeah, that's great. Thank you, April. And one more, Rob in Poughkeepsie, New York. Rob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks. This is a great conversation. I mean, I'm on my way to New York with, I guess, what you'd call more of a dumb phone, one of those older things.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't yet gotten this thing updated. But it struck me, something you said about, you know, are we feeling like a new species now? And I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I've been reading things about this biological shift that's underway that's maybe on the order of what happened when human beings started wearing clothes and began to start roaming about, you know, further north or whatever.
And what's the shift here as opposed to clothes? Then, okay, we were warmer. If we're all, you know, wireless, connected all the time, what?
Well, then, you know, now we're exchanging energy and information with the environment in a very different way than, you know, human beings have in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And what's it going to do for, as some of your previous callers were saying, you know, the nature of relationships, the distinction between public and private behavior, all these things, I mean, it's definitely a whiz-bang thing going on now. The dream of modernity is very, you know, sort of very rich with everybody. We haven't yet been able to really step back and look, though, at what's going to happen in the social sphere. It's certainly good business.
So far, and definitely outstripping the old phones. Jason, pick up on that one. Get a little cosmic with us for a second here. I mean,
there is actually an evolutionary change that's going on, and it's quite significant. We have transcended time, and we've transcended space, and we've changed what attention means. So now people are developing relationships that are occurring across the globe and actually occurring across time. These digital footprints that we're leaving, you know, where we were eating breakfast, your conversations we had at breakfast, people are going to be able to play our lives. Our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren will be able to play our lives. It would be quite fascinating to play, you know, my grandfather's life when he came here from Ireland.
But that's a kind of, okay, I mean, that would be fascinating to see him, his attitudes, his experience, but it's a kind of voyeurism. What about our actual living? I mean,
yeah, I wouldn't worry about that too much, because what we're going to synthesize this and come up with some new sort of ground rules for how we behave and how much we share and how much we don't share. Because what happens is you can overshare, and it does have negative impact on your life. People are seeing that now. College kids who go to school, and then they get Googled. And we have in my company, because I hired a lot of young people out of school, what we call sort of college amnesty. Whatever photos and behaviors occurred in, you know, before you got to our place, we're going to give you amnesty for. So those drunken photos or whatever, we're not going to give you too much, you know, credence.
right.
The really interesting thing is this idea of what Linda Stone, formerly of Microsoft and Apple, calls continuous partial attention. multitasking was a major discussion that we all had in the late 80s, early 90s when Windows came out. Oh, my God, you're doing two things at once. You're listening to music, and you're writing a document, and you're checking your email. This is insane. How could this ever work? Well, you know what? We figured out a way to do it. People now will shut down other applications. There's an entire movement on the web to only check email twice a day, and you'll probably start seeing this. You'll email somebody. You'll say, I check my email at 10, 2, and 5, and that's it, because I want to actually get real work done. Well, this continuous partial attention, you know, there are people in relationships, and the new buzzword is presence. So you have a lot of wives asking their husbands to be present, and that means checking the BlackBerry at the door, turning it off,
right,
putting it into the side table, and this incredible concept of actually paying attention when driving. We've had a lot of tragic cases in the the capital of driving, Los Angeles, where young people are texting and driving and killing people. It's just tragic. And you know what? Their fingerprints are there. The person who was who derailed the train here in Los Angeles, was texting right before it. We had a poor
happened
kid
in Boston
who,
too. Yep.
Yeah, it's horrible. And so anytime this new technology comes out, the more scared people get, the more profound the impact is. So we will resynthesize it, and we'll come to some new ground rules.
Jonna, I'm reading here, this is Kevin Kelly with Wired writing last year, saying, you know, what we're headed toward is in effect one vast computer composed of billions of chips and billions of brains enveloping the planet in a single sphere of intelligence. But that sounds to me like it depends on continuous partial attention being sort of the global standard. Everybody, you know, hooked in, mobile, and linked up all the time. What is it? Are we going to click in and out, or are we going to be constantly feeding one sort of great global brain?
Well, I guess some people are, but I'd like to drink a little less of this Kool-Aid. I actually think that these devices, as great as they are for, say, news gathering and sharing and mind casting, as Jay Rosen calls it, and things like that, they're actually much more important as information receivers. So the world I imagine is one in which you're never lost. You're never hungry. You can never not get help.
Never hungry. How does it feed me if I'm in Darfur?
It tells you where there's food.
It
tells you where the water is. You go to a map and it shows you where the satellite showed you. Mm-hmm. If you want to go down that road, I can go down that road. But the point is, you always know where you are. You can always get help. You can always get the things you need, including information and entertainment and things like that. The other part of this about always being on is something that we've always dealt with people, even when they were nearby. You have extroverted people that think that we want to know everything about them, and they act accordingly. This device enables that. It actually encourages it. And as I say, part of the learning curve when new things come out is figuring out where the boundaries are, as your other guests have said. Mm-hmm. We are figuring that part out. But when the dust settles, we'll be left with things which mean we're never alone.
Never lost, never alone. Omar?
Well, you know, back to Jason's point about are kids going to be going back through our data from when I honestly don't imagine my daughter, you know, at 15 wanting to pore over my tweets from 2008. I just don't see that.
Yeah.
We're producing vast amounts of data, even just, you know, using Twitter, the digital photos that we're creating. And there's a huge problem, I think, that we're going to have to address at some point of where does all this data go? How do we keep all this data relevant? How do we tag all this data so we can go through it later and search through it? I mean, I don't know about you, but I take hundreds of digital photos, every couple of weeks. And, you know, I don't really know what to do with them. And the same goes for the data that we're producing with our cell phones, this live casting and the videos that we're streaming. Are people really going to be that interested in it, 10 or 20 years from now? Or is it just going to be this big pile of data that nobody knows what to do with?
Jason, I'm sure people are already making big business out of that.
Well, and the answer is yes. I mean, this is not about – I'm going to disagree with the speaker earlier. This isn't about downloading. This is about uploading and then analyzing what the aggregate data. There are new sensors that are coming to mobile phones that will do things like a Holter monitor used to do. If you remember people who have heart problems, they might wear it for 24 hours and then have it reviewed after the fact. It's quite possible that in a new iPhone or a new Android phone, it will monitor your heart rate. And then what we could have is an entire map by race, age, and area of country and heart rates. And then we could analyze heart attacks. There might be correlations to heart attacks, to strokes that we are not aware of. They could be related to the stock market. They could be related to weather. All kinds of different things that this aggregate data is going to find for us. And you might be, and this sounds kind of Orwellian, if you opt into this network of monitoring my heart rate, my skin response, all this stuff, my diet, how much exercise I'm getting, you would actually hire somebody in India, perhaps, or Manila, to monitor for some fee your health and what you're doing. And if you start hitting some thresholds that would be determined by the previous thresholds that were set by the collective unconscious of, you know, people's heart rates and whatnot, biometric data, it might get escalated to a senior advisor who then might escalate it to your doctor. And your doctor might get a ping on their iPhone that says, hey, you know, Jason is having a weird heart rate right now. Look at your thing and say, you know what, I'm going to call him or text him and say, hey, calm down, or video conference. This sounds crazy. It's coming. It's right around the corner. And you might even be able to take a blood sample from your hand and put it on your iPhone or other phone, your BlackBerry's camera, and the camera will be able to read what's going on in your blood. Those kind of sensors and whatnot are coming. So it's going to change our health, and it's this data that's being collected has never been collected on this scale.
I don't have to worry about storing it. I mean, I guess that's good. On the other hand, what if I don't know, someone's just having falling in love, and somebody in Manila is paying attention to their heart rate. Rick in Iowa City, Iowa. Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You can call me an ancient paranoid, I guess, but I'm wondering what the what this new technology might mean for privacy and government intrusion. And my second question would be, excuse me, about national security. If they can set off explosive devices with dumb phones, do they have any type of thing in the pipe for defenses against this type of technology? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Rick, we'll do it. Ancient paranoids, welcome. John Abel, what do you say to those two questions?
There's nothing particularly unique about the smartphone as far as setting off IEDs go. I mean, they are location aware and the sort of and this sort of thing. People have strong feelings, I guess, about GPS and the fact that
pinpoints where you are all the time.
Yeah, you know, you know where you are based on the information, but you would have to do things in order to sort of share with the world where you are, which is what these smartphones do if you want them to. The general rule is that applications and devices should allow you to opt in to location awareness, in other words, broadcasting where you are, and should not by default
automatically
tell people,
track you.
Right. But people, I think, should be genuinely, whether they call themselves paranoid seriously or not, they should be genuinely concerned when technology exists within the bowels of devices and code that can actually do this. You're always dealing with a trust imperative with the companies and the entities you're working with. So I wouldn't discourage somebody from being cautious and wary.
How do you know?
Don't worry about the government. The government will not have to track us. We're going to opt into it. This is more about Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame, or Josh Harris's "We Live in Public" 15 minutes of fame every day.
Oh boy.
The government. It could never have conceived of collecting the information they're collecting now on Twitter. We've opted in to Big Brother.
As a species. One more call. Kirsten, Arlington, Massachusetts. Kirsten, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kirsten.
I want to talk about something that hasn't come up, which is a significant upside for me of having a G1 and having the possibility of being connected at all times, is that now I really am forced to make conscious choices about when I am and am not connected, and to what. I now decide, okay, am I just walking along the Charles River, or is this a time when I want to be getting texts from my brother who's in a life or death situation in a hospital and can't call, or more commonly, I'm having dinner in Harvard Square, I want to see, is it raining in Belmont, what time is the movie playing at the Capitol Theater in Arlington. I now make those choices, and I found the time I have when I'm not connected is better and more high quality because I'm forced to make those choices in a way I didn't and couldn't 2 years ago when I had all the technology, but it was all in different places.
So the device prompts you to be more mindful.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm not, I'm sunk.
Yeah, yes, we got it. Kirsten, our time is short. Omar Gayaga, there's a kind of, I mean, the technology may wrap us up six ways to Sunday, but there's a human mind deciding to make its own decisions within that mobile computing envelope.
Yeah, I'm still wrapping my brain around the blood sample that I'm going to send on my smartphone.
Right. And your alcohol content maybe at every given moment. Maybe it's a policeman pulling you over.
Right. But no, she brings up a great point. I mean, really, I think that's the danger. And I think that's what we're seeing with the texting while driving issue is people who are not making the conscious choice to not be connected at any given moment. I mean, I went to a performance by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs at the Austin City Limits Festival, and I was, you know, taking pictures and trying to video stream and doing all this stuff. And I missed the concert. You know, I was right there in front.
Be here now, man. Right.
So, yeah, that's the danger. You know, you're trying to capture the moment and you miss the moment.
With that warning and the upside that Kirsten brings us of it's a prompt to be mindful if we use it that way, we'll roll on for today. Great conversation, and I'm grateful to each of you. Omar Gayag at the Austin American Statesman, thanks for being on, Omar. We'll talk to you again. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
John Abel, New York Bureau Chief for Wired.com. Wonderful to have you, John. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Jason Calacanis in Los Angeles, California, CEO there of Mahalo.com. Jason, thank you for your thoughts today.
Mahalo for having me.
Mahalo right back to you. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.